time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the question-and-answer session, you can press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. Today's conference is being recorded, so if you have any objections, you can disconnect at this time. And now I'd like to turn the call over to Mr. Gary Browns. You may begin, sir.
Thank you very much. Hi, everybody, and thanks for joining us for the National Kidney Foundation's Coffee House Conversations. Tonight we're going to be talking about why managing high blood sugar is so important, and what you can do and what your healthcare provider can do. This program's been funded by Boehringer Ingelheim Pharmaceuticals. It's the first topic in a three-part series called Diabetes, Your Actions Can Make a Difference. And you may be wondering why the National Kidney Foundation is hosting a series about diabetes, and with the help of our speakers tonight, well, hopefully you'll know why. With us tonight, we have Dr. Catherine Tuttle. Dr. Tuttle is the Medical and Scientific Director of Providence Medical Research Center in Spokane, Washington. She is a clinical professor of medicine at the University of Washington School of Medicine, and she is a leading expert in the areas of both diabetes and kidney disease. She's made a number of important research contributions in those areas. And we're also going to hear from Rick. Rick has type 2 diabetes and chronic kidney disease. And tonight, Rick's going to share a little bit about his own experience about living with diabetes and kidney disease. And this call is going to be about an hour and a half long. Together, our two speakers are going to talk for about 30 minutes, and then right after that, we'll have a chance for you to ask questions or share your own thoughts. And right now, everybody's phones are muted, so unless you're a speaker, when it's time to open up the discussions for your questions, we'll let you know. And then we'll let you know how you can do that. So right now, without further ado, let me introduce our first speaker for the evening. This is Rick. Why don't you say hello, Rick? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hi. First, I want to say that I'm really happy to participate in this. I'm from Alabama in the Deep South, where it's really hot right now. And just to give everybody a point of reference, I'm currently 57 years old. And I always knew that my maternal grandmother was diabetic and that two of her brothers had been diabetic and one had gone blind and one had had feet amputated. But I never learned that I was at risk for diabetes because of this family history. I don't know why that was never made clear to me. So at age 32, I started feeling really bad, and I went to my doctor with a list of my symptoms, and he later told me that usually when people come in with a list, he thinks they're hypochondriacs. But the list I had was most of the symptoms for diabetes, and so I was tested. And the diagnosis of diabetes type 2 was confirmed. And I was surprised. I just didn't expect this at all, but I tried to accept it and didn't really realize the impact of this diagnosis on my life until a few weeks later. I'd been to a party with some friends, and through the evening I drank diet sodas and stuck to raw vegetables and chips and crackers and things and avoided all the wonderful, luscious sweets that I always enjoyed. And when I was driving home, I started thinking about the fact that I was never going to be able to eat those things again as long as I lived, and I would have to continue to test my own blood glucose levels every day for the rest of my life. And it hit me so hard, I actually had to pull over to the side of the road and cry for a minute, which is just not my usual style of living. But I pulled myself together, and I made the changes I had to make. I took a great class on living with diabetes through the University of Alabama at Birmingham. And then I took my medications and followed my diet as was prescribed and did my best to make it part of my routine. And treatment was very effective in keeping my A1C under control. And I loved getting reports of my A1C because that let me know how I was doing. And I also learned at this point that I was at risk for kidney disease through the classes that I took on living with diabetes. However, a few years ago, during a hospitalization, the doctor told me that my kidney function was low and referred me to a nephrologist. At this point, my kidneys were only working at about 21% of normal function. And I was shocked. But I knew I didn't feel well, And after discussing it and learning the options, I suggested to my doctor that I start dialysis in the hopes that I would feel better. Unfortunately, I didn't get really good information about dialysis in the beginning, but I did learn the hard way that I wasn't a candidate for peritoneal dialysis. I actually had the surgery, but they determined that my abdomen was so filled with scar tissue and adhesions that I was not a good candidate. So I started hemodialysis, and I'm doing really well on it. All of my test result numbers, which we get monthly, are really wonderful. In fact, my dialysis is so effective that at the moment, when I go 3 days for my treatments 3 days a week, I only need to be on the dialysis machine for 2.5 hours instead of the 4 hours that they started me on. That's a relief. But even at 4 hours, it's worth it because you feel so much better than you do without it. And I feel so good these days that I even walk the mile that it is from my home to my hemodialysis treatments when the weather's good. But through all this, I really feel like one of the most important things is your source of support, family, friends. And my main source of support is my partner, Wayne, although my friends and my mother at 77 has been a great help too. But Wayne is always there for me. I don't drive anymore, so he drives me everywhere I need to go, all my doctor's visits. He goes with me for my doctor's visits, make sure I get to dialysis and where I need to be. And I've got to tell you, it's really good to know that you've got someone who has your back. It's just a great feeling. And one of my big successes, I think, during my diabetes and kidney is following the diet. I learned what I can eat and what I can't eat, and I stick to it. And that is so important in so many ways.
Well, that's great, Rick. Thank you very much for sharing. We appreciate hearing your story. Sounds convenient. The dialysis center is a mile away. That's it's a nice opportunity to walk it if you can. That's great.
It's very nice.
Now I'm going to turn the call over to our clinical expert, who is Dr. Tuttle. And we're very glad to have you here tonight with us, Dr. Tuttle. So let me ask you, can you begin by explaining to everybody who's listening what diabetes is?
Sure. Well, I too would like to thank the National Kidney Foundation for the opportunity to participate in this coffeehouse conversation, because Rick has so eloquently told us his story and about the importance of being aware of diabetes and managing diabetes well in the setting of kidney disease, but we can also talk a little bit about the importance of what strategies we can take to either prevent onset of kidney disease or progression of kidney disease. So let's start by defining diabetes. Diabetes is defined by a high blood sugar, also called blood glucose level, and you'll hear me use the term glucose, because there are a number of sugars in our bodies, and not all sugars are related to diabetes. So we're really talking about the blood sugar glucose. And a high blood glucose level can cause problems throughout the body. But the good news is that if we control blood glucose, we can reduce or slow the progression of complications such as kidney disease. And even though at this point, diabetes is not curable for most people, it can be managed well, not only with medicines, but diet and exercise. And Rick told you about how he walks to his diabetes treatments when he can, and every little bit of activity counts. So we need to remember that, and that people with diabetes can live a long, happy, and active lifestyle.
So let me ask you this, doctor. I hear people talk about type 1 diabetes, type 2 diabetes. Obviously, there's different types.
Well, type 1 diabetes results from an absolute deficiency or lack of insulin in the body. And this is also known as juvenile diabetes, and it's the type that typically starts in childhood or as a young adult, although it occasionally occurs in older people. And it usually is characterized by an abrupt onset of severe illness, particularly increased thirst and urination and severe fatigue, loss of appetite. And it has to be treated with insulin because the body doesn't make enough to control blood glucose. But even in type 1 diabetes, where insulin is absolutely required, healthy diet and physical activity are very important in managing the disease. But this accounts for only about 5% of all cases of diabetes, at least in the North America and the developed world.
And type 2 diabetes?
Well, this is the type of diabetes that used to be known as adult-onset diabetes and more commonly occurs in adults, particularly people over the age of 40, although we're seeing more and more cases now, even into youth, because of the obesity epidemic. And this is the type of diabetes that is preventable in many cases. And the main factors that increase risk of diabetes and that we can control include being overweight, lack of physical activity, and poor diet. Family history also contributes, but of course that's not something that most people can change. This is the most common type of diabetes occurring in about 95% of cases in North America and the developed world. And in many cases, type 2 diabetes can be managed with diet and physical activity in the earlier stages, but in most cases, people eventually require medical treatment. In the beginning, pills or oral agents can be used, but most people, after many years of diabetes, will require insulin even in type 2 diabetes because the pancreas begins to burn out and can't make enough insulin to overcome the body's resistance to insulin. And in fact, most people with CKD will eventually be on insulin.
Okay.
And CKD, I guess I should define here for this group, is chronic kidney disease or kidney disease related to diabetes.
So if you don't control the diabetes, what happens?
Well, most people don't die directly from high blood glucose. The reason that high blood glucose causes such havoc is that it leads to a number of complications. And these complications predominantly involve the blood vessels, both small and large. The small blood vessel disease has the medical term microvascular disease, and this is disease that occurs in the eye, the kidneys, and the nerves. Large blood vessel disease, or macrovascular disease, is blood vessel disease that occurs in organs such as the heart, causing heart attacks, or in the brain, a major cause of stroke. The best way to avoid these serious health problems is control of diabetes and getting your blood glucose levels to goal. And it clearly reduces the risk of the microvascular complications, particularly eye, kidney, and nerve problems.
So let me ask you, how do you know if your blood sugar level is under control?
Well, blood glucose has to be monitored, and this is very important. Most of all, we encourage self-management, including self-monitoring of blood glucose with a blood glucose meter. It's a simple test done by patients themselves. Depending on the clinical situation, it's done one or more times per day, usually 2 to 4 times per day. It gives an indication of the blood sugar at that moment in time and helps people determine what to eat, how much physical activity they can do, and if they're on insulin, what kind of insulin adjustments they need to make. Your healthcare team will teach you how to use your blood glucose meter and how to set your blood glucose goal. This may include not only your physician, but diabetes educators, nurses, and pharmacists are all part of the team who work with people on blood sugar goals and self-management. It's important to keep a record, to have a logbook of what your blood glucose numbers are and what's going on. I'll often encourage patients to write a comment about how they're feeling or what might be happening that'll help us understand their blood glucose control when we review their records. And as I mentioned before, this helps us look at your medicines, but on a day-to-day basis, it's important in terms of making decisions about food activity and insulin adjustments. Now, the other way blood glucose is monitored is with the hemoglobin A1C or A1C test. This is a test that's done either at your healthcare professional's office or a clinical lab, and it's an indicator of what your long-term average blood glucose has been. Usually it reflects about 3 months' period of time. And along with your daily self-management measurements of blood glucose, the A1C test is used to assess how well your diabetes is controlled. Now, currently, the National Diabetes Education Program and other professional and government agencies concerned with diabetes have stood by an A1C goal of about 7% or less, although there are some recent trials that show us that patients who have long-standing diabetes and complications such as kidney disease and heart disease may do better with a slightly higher goal. On the other hand, younger people with new-onset diabetes who don't have complications may do better with a lower goal. So the important message for those of you on the line is that your goal needs to be individualized depending on your particular circumstance, and that's where it's important that you work very closely with your physician to define your goal and then with the whole team to get there. The A1C test should be performed regularly if you're stable and at goal, twice per year or about every 6 months. If your blood glucose levels are not stable or you're not meeting your goals, then more often about quarterly or every 3 months.
I see. Okay, so I understand how important it is to monitor blood sugar, and I know the healthcare team can help me teach me how to do that. But how do I keep my blood sugar under control? What do I need to do?
Well, it depends on the type of diabetes that you have. In type 1 diabetes, blood sugar is controlled by taking insulin and following a meal plan. With type 2 diabetes, as I mentioned in the beginning, sometimes the disease or the blood glucose can be controlled with physical activity and nutrition. But most of the time, medicine will also be needed. And in the beginning, these are oral medicines or pills, and there are many different types that can be prescribed, and some help your pancreas make more insulin, and others increase your response to insulin or decrease your resistance to insulin. Eventually, though, most people with type 2 diabetes will also end up on insulin, and it's important to talk to your healthcare professional, again, about your individual situation and what type of medicine is appropriate for you. But for all people with diabetes, types 1 and 2, remember physical activity and good nutrition are still the foundation of managing diabetes.
So what would happen if my blood sugar is not under control then?
Well, again, serious problems, particularly the complications, small and large vessel. And the evidence is strongest, actually, for producing small vessel disease, that is the eye, kidney, and nerve problems. And with regard to the eye disease, it's important to recognize that the eyes depend on a network of tiny blood vessels to process images so that we can actually see the world around us. And high blood glucose directly damages these small blood vessels that eventually results in damage leading to loss of vision and finally blindness. In fact, diabetes is the number one cause of blindness in North America and the developed world. But it's important to recognize that most people with diabetes have type 2 diabetes, and the vast majority of people with type 2 diabetes also have high blood pressure. And we know that high blood pressure along with high blood glucose also contributes to damage in the eye. So it's important to control blood glucose, but it's also critical that people with diabetes control blood pressure in order to preserve their vision.
So can eye problems from diabetes be prevented?
Well, yes, and again, by management of the risk factors, that is glucose and blood pressure, but it's also important to have a yearly eye exam every year, either by an optometrist or an ophthalmologist who's experienced in evaluating people for diabetic eye disease, so that if there are changes in vision despite your best efforts, there are some treatments that they offer that can also help with preserving vision.
Okay, so you mentioned that high blood sugar can cause damage to the nerves in your body. So two questions. What do nerves do, and what does nerve damage, what does nerve damage happen, and which nerves are usually affected?
Well, the nerves carry our messages between brain and all other parts of our body. So if you touch something hot or you step on a sharp object, the nerves let you know by a painful sensation that you've done something harmful, and they tell the brain to pull back. If you touch a hot pot, you pull your hand back immediately, or if you step on a sharp object, you pull your foot back, and it's the nerve that communicates the message that there's been damage, and then a signal back from the brain that says, step away. So high blood glucose levels over time lead to damage to nerves because these nerves also depend on a blood supply from the network of tiny blood vessels that I've talked about that occur are very important in terms of eye function. They're similar type of nerve or blood vessels supply the nerves. So when they lose their circulation due to chronic levels of high blood glucose, they begin to function improperly. And the hands and feet, interestingly enough, are most commonly affected. We call this the stocking glove distribution. And some of the earliest findings are numbness in the hands and feet. And I would say from years of clinical experience, the feet are even more often affected than the hands. And the other thing, too, is that sometimes people have strange sensations. Another really common sensation in the feet is what I call hot feet. If something touches their feet, like when they get in bed at night and pull the sheets up, when the sheets touch their feet, they feel like they're on fire. And other people have tingling. So these are some of the earlier signs. But the nerves also affect things like heart function and digestive function. And some people with nerve damage get to the point that they have difficulty even with digesting their food. So it's a very serious problem. And the loss of sensation in the feet is one of the contributors to amputations. And as I mentioned, damage to the gastrointestinal system or the digestive system can lead to many problems with nutrition if the ability to eat and process food is affected.
Okay, so heart and blood vessels. What about heart and blood vessels? What can you tell us?
Well, diabetes is a major risk factor for heart and blood vessel disease. And again, I'd like to specify this would be large blood vessel disease, which also includes blood vessels to the brain that lead to stroke. However, we've learned from recent clinical trials that overly intensive blood glucose control does not prevent stroke or heart attack events. It probably is true that bringing the blood glucose down from very high levels to moderate levels provides some benefit, but it's relatively minimal. The main benefit from glycemic control to date has been on the microvascular circulation, so that would be eye and kidney in particular. However, people with diabetes can reduce the risk of heart attack and stroke by two other very important risk factor approaches. One is controlling blood pressure, which I already mentioned. Remember that 95% of people in this country have type 2 diabetes, and about 90% of them have hypertension. Mm-hmm. And we know from a large body of clinical trials, those are studies of people with diabetes and hypertension, that control of blood pressure clearly reduces risk of heart and stroke events, especially if certain types of blood pressure medicines are used. The other major approach to reducing cardiovascular risk in diabetes is control of cholesterol, LDL or bad cholesterol. And again, large body of clinical evidence in diabetic patients has shown that, first off, most of them have high LDL cholesterol levels and that with lowering these with certain types of medicines, that the risk of heart attack and stroke can be reduced.
And food choices, I guess.
Well, food is always important in terms of risk factor control, whether we're talking about blood glucose, blood pressure, or cholesterol. With regard to blood pressure, perhaps the most important thing is limiting sodium intake. With regard to cholesterol, it's limiting saturated fat and cholesterol intake.
Okay. Any other suggestions, heart and blood vessel problems, how you can stop them?
Well, I think physical activity and weight loss is also critical.
Uh-huh. How about smoking?
Smoking cessation as well. That's, I think, probably the hardest thing for people to do because cigarettes are so addictive and other forms of tobacco as well. But I think it's worth the effort to help people stop because if they do, it makes a difference and it does reduce their risks.
Okay, thanks. So let's switch gears a little bit and talk about the kidneys. How does high blood sugar cause damage to the kidneys?
Okay, back to the small vessel circulation again. So the kidney, along with the nerves and the eye, is an organ very dependent on an intricate network of very small blood vessels. High blood glucose directly damages those blood vessels and gets them to the point that they cannot carry out their function, which is to filter the blood and cleanse it of waste products. Kidney disease is very common in people with diabetes. Overall, about 40%, but if we break that down, it's about 30% of type 1 diabetic patients, 50%, that's half of people with type 2 diabetes, and in some populations who are overrepresented with type 2 diabetes, particularly people of color, the rate of kidney disease is even higher than 50%. For example, in some Native American tribes, 75% of people with diabetes will develop diabetic kidney disease.
Wow.
The number one cause of kidney failure in the United States and the developed world, and in fact, in the most recent data that we have in the United States, as of 2009, 54%, that's more than half of new cases of all of end-stage renal disease requiring dialysis or kidney transplant are now attributed to diabetes.
Oh, boy. Well, you mentioned that one out of three people with diabetes may get kidney disease. That's really serious. I wonder if everyone who's listening today knows what chronic kidney disease is.
Yes, and again, I'd like to update those figures. It's really 4 out of 10... or 2 out of 5, and in type 2 diabetes, it's half.
Okay.
And that's what most people on the call probably have.
Uh-huh.
So this is very serious. There have been national surveys done that show that the complication of diabetes that is least recognized among people who have diabetes is the risk of kidney disease. So we really need to get the message out there about how important diabetes is as a risk factor for kidney disease. Let's start by talking what the kidneys do, how they keep you healthy, and then what chronic kidney disease is. So, as I mentioned earlier, the kidney's job is to remove waste products, balance body fluids, that is, make sure you have enough but not too much, critical to control and regulation of blood pressure and a number of hormones. Most people don't recognize the kidney as an endocrine organ, but it actually makes hormones that regulate diverse functions, such as production of red blood cells, believe it or not. Also, hormones that regulate bone health and keep our minerals in balance. So one way people have described the function of the kidneys is to think about a coffee filter. So when you make coffee, the filter keeps the coffee grains inside the filter but allows water to pass through. So your kidneys do something similar in that they keep the things you need inside your body but filter out waste and extra fluid. And once your kidneys become damaged, and in particular the small vessel circulation which delivers blood to the filters, then the filtering doesn't take place. Waste products and fluid accumulate. And when this is clinically evident by laboratory tests, we call it chronic kidney disease. And in medicine, we have a number of acronyms. So this is another one. It goes by CKD for chronic kidney disease. We recognize 5 stages, 1 to 5, with 1 being the very earliest indication. In the setting of diabetes, this is usually the beginning of starting to leak albumin, a blood protein, into the urine. And then stage 5 is the stage of kidney failure, usually requiring kidney replacement therapy in the form of dialysis or a transplant. We think it's so important to detect kidney disease in the early stages because we have treatment, and treatment works at this stage. But once people have very advanced disease, there's little we can do other than prepare them for kidney replacement therapy in the form of a transplant or dialysis.
How would somebody know if they have kidney disease?
Well, this is a challenging issue because in the early stages, there essentially are no symptoms. It's another one of the famous, quote, silent killers. And it has to be detected by laboratory testing. All people with diabetes need an annual urine test. Not only urinalysis to look for blood or infection or other sorts of problems, but importantly to look for a protein called albumin, which is one of the earliest blood proteins that begins to spill into the urine when the kidney filters are damaged. And when albumin in the urine increases in diabetes, this is usually a sign of diabetic kidney disease. The other test is a GFR test, and this is a blood test that is an indication of how well your kidneys are functioning, how well the filter is working.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so here's the key question. What can people with diabetes do to help prevent kidney disease?
Well, the most important thing is control of blood glucose and blood, and then also control of blood pressure. Self-monitoring of blood glucose we've talked about, but people with diabetes should be monitoring their blood pressure as well. And then they should be working on setting goals for both blood glucose and blood pressure based on their individual circumstances and using lifestyle, that is diet and physical activity, along with medicine to get to those goals. Make sure you get the kidney disease tests at least once per year and take the medicines that are prescribed for you to lower your blood glucose, your blood pressure, and your cholesterol. And remember, the lowering blood cholesterol is mainly important for reducing risk of heart attack and stroke. Lowering blood pressure is really important for both small and large vessel complications, so it's heart, stroke, kidney, eye in particular. And blood sugar or blood glucose control is particularly important for eye, kidney, and nerve. So eat a healthy diet, stay active. People with diabetes can use alcohol, but in moderation. And those are along the guidelines of what is recommended for the general population. One drink, not more than one drink per day in women or two drinks per day in men. Don't start smoking, for heaven's sake, and if you are a smoker, work on smoking cessation. In addition to reducing heart and stroke risk, there's also some evidence that smoking cessation reduces the rate at which kidney disease progresses in diabetic patients. Keep your appointments, be accountable, and let the healthcare team work with you to achieve your goals and hopefully remain healthy and live long and well with diabetes.
Wow, thank you very much. That was a lot of information, but I'm sure everyone listening so far has learned a lot. We're going to have time for questions soon, but before we move on to questions, I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about self-management, because I know this is a very important part of diabetes care. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Self-management is really critical, and I've alluded to it already. And in particular, this applies to management of blood glucose and blood pressure. But even though you may not be measuring your cholesterol at home day to day, it's still important to be watching your diet. So really all the risk factors we've talked about are addressed in self-management. That's the day-to-day care of diabetes, which is up to you when you're living your real life. You can choose what, when, and how much to eat. And healthy meal planning is a really important part of your diabetes management. Decide to be active within whatever physical constraints you have. Increasing movement helps no matter what you can do. You don't have to become an elite athlete. Even a little bit of walking most days is helpful. And again, Rick talked to us about even now while on dialysis, he's still incorporating walking into his life each day, which is a wonderful example. And physical activity, along with controlling weight at any stage of kidney disease, is helpful in terms of managing blood pressure, blood glucose, and cholesterol. Take your medicines and keep track of your blood glucose and blood pressure levels so that when you see your healthcare team, they can work with you to achieve goals if you're not there, or give you a high five if you're getting there. Everybody could use some support and encouragement. Also, try to learn what symptoms or changes may indicate that you're not doing so well and when you need to see a healthcare professional. You may want to pay attention to symptoms, for example, on the nerve damage. We talked about numbness of the hands and feet, and particularly the feet. And one thing I want to talk a minute about here is feet. It's important to inspect your feet each day. Sometimes it's hard to see your own feet, and then when you've lost feeling, you might not know if you've damaged your feet. So your feet should always be evaluated at every healthcare encounter. So when you go in to see your doctor or nurse practitioner or whoever, take your shoes and socks off. In fact, that's a rule in my clinic. Everybody with diabetes has to take their shoes and socks off. Make sure they're looking at your feet. Ask questions. Get them answered. Be assertive about your health care because it's really your life and you're your own best advocate. And sometimes it's good to share with other people who are going through some of the same things you are to know you're not alone and get ideas from them about what works for them, and maybe you can share with them about things that work for you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Tuttle. That was great, great information. I really appreciate you joining us here. You covered a lot of important questions. Rick, you still with us?
I'm here.
Can you tell us a little bit about your own experience with self-management?
Sure. As I was saying earlier, diet is so important in both diabetes and in kidney disease. And what works for me, I discovered early on, was to forget about the foods I can't eat and focus on the foods I can eat. Wayne and I only stock our pantry with foods I can have. And we fall in the category of foodies. And we collect recipes, and we're both good cooks, so we eat well, despite not being able to eat everything. And although we do eat very well, we both lost a lot of weight by sticking to my diet. And yes, we both stick to my diet. It's just easier that way. And I would just recommend that anyone who is on a diabetic diet or a kidney diet or both, try this. Just concentrate on what you can have and ignore the things that you cannot have.
Okay.
And I continue to, I forgot to mention that I continue to follow closely the prescribed medical plan that my physician and my clinic, the dietitian at dialysis, all these things I follow. I take my medications as directed, monitor my blood glucose level twice a day, and I also recommend, and this is very important, anyone with diabetes, because since there are no clues to having kidney disease, anybody with kidneys, including my two brothers, be tested for kidney disease, because I've learned that the earlier it's found, the earlier it can be treated.
It's right along the lines with what Dr. Tuttle was telling us. Guys, thank you very much for your informative presentations there. I really appreciate that, sharing your stories and the information. And now we're going to open up the discussion to all of you on the call today. So please feel free to call in and ask questions. Your questions can be about diabetes or kidney disease or self-management, and we're opening up the call for you to do that now.
Thank you, Mr. Bronze. Again, if you do want to ask a question, you just need to press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. It will prompt you to record your name, and that is just so that I can introduce you with the question. If you hear your question asked and would like to withdraw your request, just press star 2. So that's star 1 to ask a question, star 2 to withdraw it. And also, the host wanted me to ask you to please continue to hold after the question and answer session, because they do have a survey that they'd like everybody to take. So we'll get to that a little bit later. And Nancy Smith, your line is open.
Hey, I'm on a drug for diabetes, but it's giving me these low sugars in the middle of the night. And I'm really kind of worried about taking it, so sometimes I don't take it because I don't want to get the low sugar. So what do you think of that?
Dr. Tuttle, you want to take that question?
Sure. Well, Nancy, if you're developing low blood sugar, which is also known as hypoglycemia at night, there probably you ought to talk to your healthcare professional about making some adjustments, because hypoglycemia is one of the complications of treatment that it can actually be problematic. And, of course, we can't give individual advice over the phone, but I think that is something that I would refer you back to your healthcare professional to talk to about making some adjustments there.
Well, is that going to make me more likely to have kidney disease, or if I don't take my drug for blood sugar?
Well, I think that gets the issue of individualizing your goal, and the ideal would be to get you to goal without hypoglycemic episodes. So there are ways to control blood glucose to goal that don't lead to low blood sugars.
Well, are there drugs that are special for people with kidney disease that probably they should be on if they...
Yes, there are preferred medicines for people with kidney disease and certain adjustments that should be made in the setting of kidney disease.
Nancy, thank you.
Do you have diabetic
disease? Thank you for the call. I wish that we could continue with this one, but unfortunately we have some other callers waiting. So I can tell you this, if you need more information, feel free to go to the National Kidney Foundation's website. And this is for everybody now. The website here is www.kidney.org/coffeehouse. And you can also, we're going to have a list of resources there available for you on the website. And you can also call us here at the National Kidney Foundation with any questions about kidney disease or diabetes. The number here is 800-622-9010. I'll give that number out again before the end of the call. But once again, it's 800-622-9010. And I can let you know that we're going to have a package of resources that are going to be sent out to everybody that's on this call. So included in the package is a list of organizations, websites, telephone numbers that you can contact for more information. Any other questions that we have now?
Yeah, we have a question from Ellen Grove. Your line is open.
Hi there. I have a question for Dr. Tuttle in reference to urine tests. Is the albumin measured when a small sample is taken, or is the 24-hour urine accumulation needed for that?
Thanks for that question, Ellen. It's actually a very good one. The urine albumin can be very reliably estimated by a spot urine or just the pee in the cup method without the 24-hour urine. Years past, we used to do 24-hour urines, but we've been able to validate that the spot urine is just as accurate. In some ways, for various reasons, it actually may be more reliable. There's still occasions where we may do a 24-hour urine, but that's usually a secondary test after the spot urine. But most of the time now, we're just doing the spot urine, so it's much easier now that a 24-hour urine isn't required.
Is it also possible for you to discuss anemia in CKD?
Sure. As I mentioned during the presentation, the kidneys are an endocrine organ. They make hormones. One of the important ones is erythropoietin. It's a hormone that regulates red blood cell production by the bone marrow. In the setting of kidney disease, damage to the kidney reduces their ability to make erythropoietin. And interestingly enough, in diabetes, it tends to occur earlier than in other forms of CKD. So we'll often see people as early as stage 3, that is the earliest reduction in GFR with anemia due to CKD. How to manage anemia has become somewhat controversial as a result of various clinical trials. In most cases, what we're going to do is start with making sure that you're replete in iron and B vitamins. If the anemia is severe, we can replace erythropoietin with injections, but some of the clinical trials have raised caution about overcorrecting anemia or correcting it in the earliest stages. So for any particular questions regarding whether or not anemia should be corrected in a particular patient's case, that'd have to be referred to their individual health care providers.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much for the question.
Darlene, I'm sorry.
That's okay. No, just before we get to the next question, I just want to remind people that we're going to have another Coffee House conversation coming up next month. It's going to be on Tuesday, July 13th. The topic is what you need to know about diabetes and your kidneys. Again, it's a free call, and we encourage all of you to listen in. Why don't we take the next question?
Okay, Darlene Edwards, your line is open.
Go ahead, Darlene.
Thank you. Thank you. I want to know what effect genetics has on the kidney disease. For instance, if someone in your family had diabetes and had kidney failure, how likely that would be to influence you getting it?
Family history. Very good. Well, Dr. Tuttle?
Yes, Darlene, another great question. Actually, family history and genetics are really very important in diabetic kidney disease. It turns out that if you have a family member with diabetes who has had diabetic kidney disease or even kidney disease from another cause, the risk of that individual's the risk of developing diabetic kidney disease is increased 5 to 6-fold over the background risk, so it really increases the risk a lot. And we think that that's one of the reasons why in certain ethnic populations the risk is so high, for example, in some of the Indian tribes, which are fairly homogenous genetically. There's no single gene that's been identified. It's really a combination of genes that tends to occur together. But it's really very important. And the National Kidney Foundation has a program that goes by the acronym KEEP, K-E-E-P, which has screened a number of individuals in communities across the country. There are other health screenings, but in any family where there's been a history of a kidney transplant or end-stage renal disease, whether the person has diabetes or not, they have a greatly increased risk of developing kidney disease, so those people should be screened. And then in the particular setting of diabetes, there's also, you know, if you have type 2 diabetes, you got a 50-50 chance of getting diabetic kidney disease, and then you raise it 5 to 6-fold if a family member has had the need for dialysis or a transplant. So we know it's important, but the science of it is still relatively undeveloped.
Thank you very much. You know, thank you for your call. And just let people know, KEEP, that Dr. Tuttle had mentioned, stands for Kidney Early Evaluation Program. That's a very important program that we have here at the National Kidney Foundation. You can get information about that also on our website, which is www.kidney.org. There's a section on there for KEEP, and it will tell where there's the next screening is going to take place, and should be one in your area hopefully soon. Any other questions?
Oh, plenty. We have one from John Reisinger. Your line is open, sir.
I got two questions. One is, what is where can I get a list of good and bad foods that I can check out? And secondly, on pain pills, Advil, Tylenol, Aleve, so which is the good ones and the bad ones?
Well, in terms of good and bad foods, we do have information on the on our National Kidney Foundation website, so I would suggest checking there, and perhaps if Dr. Tuttle has some other suggestions.
That's www.kidney.org.
Yeah, www.kidney.org.
Okay.
There's a section on there for patient information. And you can also call, if you're having trouble finding stuff on there, you can feel free to give us a call at 800-622-9010. And we actually have nutritionists on staff that might be able to help you with that.
By the way, I can put in a plug for you for your thing where you have once a year or so on, where you go for half a day. I went to that. It was very, 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 very good.
Oh, that's great to hear. Yeah, thank you very much. And your other question regarding the medicine, Dr. Tuttle, would you care to address that?
Yes, John, and I will make one more comment about the food. The other thing that National Kidney Foundation does is they have a kidney chef who happens to be a good friend of mine. And besides kind of telling you good foods, bad foods, there are a number of wonderful recipes, a lot of maybe good old-fashioned comfort foods that have been adapted for people with chronic kidney disease, so that might be helpful to you as well, not only what you can and can't eat, but maybe how to make them taste good too. So then secondarily, with regard to pain medicines, this is a real challenge in the setting of kidney disease because a lot of pain medicines, really all of them you mentioned, can actually aggravate kidney damage. The worst among them are the nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs or the arthritis-type painkillers like Aleve, Advil, ibuprofen, naproxen, which are available over-the-counter, so people mistakenly think they're safe. And in the setting of kidney disease, they can cause a decrease in kidney function and they can raise your blood pressure. So there are some situations where people just have to have them, but they need to be used judiciously and in consultation with your healthcare professional about whether you can or can't take them and how many. And even Tylenol and narcotic-type painkillers, when used in large amounts for years and years, can lead to kidney damage. And the medical term is analgesic nephropathy. And the last thing in diabetes we want to do is add any additional form of kidney disease, especially that caused by ingestion of a drug. So all the pain pills are problematic. It's not that we endorse, you know, suffering of people, but sometimes there are ways to manage pain that doesn't involve pills, and that's been highly successful, you know, in a number of my own patients. So I would encourage you to talk to your physician about what options might be there if you're having trouble with pain.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you very much for that question, caller.
Hey, Andrew Eichel, your line is open.
Yes, my questions are, first, I've read in a magazine article that certain medications for blood pressure, like beta blockers, can lower the, the insulin, excuse me, and can possibly cause diabetes, and I was wondering if you can comment on that. And also, Can you tell me if it makes a difference, you know, for a person with diabetes, you know, in terms of eating schedule? You know, should you try to eat more small meals, or would, you know, maybe a couple meals a day or something, you know, be okay? Or what are your recommendations there?
What do you think, Dr. Tuttle? Beta blockers,
and actually some diuretics, they do have a mild effect to slightly raise blood glucose. But there have been some very good studies that have shown that they don't, that if anything, those drugs, when taken for blood pressure, reduce diabetic complications. So in balance, you're better off taking them. And the effect on blood glucose is minimal. I mean, we're talking 1 or 2 points in large studies. Hmm. So, you know, I think most of us stand by the importance of using those drugs for blood pressure control. You'd be worse off without them, is the bottom line, because why are we trying to treat diabetes? We're trying to prevent complications. And by controlling blood pressure, you end up ahead, even if your blood glucose goes up slightly. And that can often be managed easily with lifestyle or medicine adjustments.
And the other question, I think, was about
frequency of meals.
Yeah, better to eat small meals throughout the course of the day?
Well, you know, that one's hard to answer because it depends, again, on individual circumstances. But in general, it's better to eat, I think, 3 or 4 smaller meals than 1 or 2 large meals. But, again, that's something that I think should be individualized based on your own circumstance.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thanks for that call. Do we have time for another one, I think?
Marjorie Hall, your line is open.
Yes, this is Marjorie Hall. Before I started dialysis, I was on insulin. And since I started dialysis, I don't have to take insulin no more. So am I still a diabetic, or what do I do?
Marjorie, your experience is really typical of many people who go on dialysis with type 2 diabetes. So, you know, you probably followed the typical course, which is as you had diabetes for longer, your kidney disease progressed, you ended up on insulin. And then when you went on dialysis, you didn't need it anymore. And there are a number of reasons for that. Some with the dialysis, some of the cleansing of your blood actually reduces your body's resistance to insulin. So your body is still making some. It just wasn't enough before. Now it may be enough, too. So you still have diabetes, but good for you. You don't have to take insulin, but it's still important, especially to watch your diet and to be as active as you can. And you may go on for a long time without needing any medicine. If your blood glucose goes up, they might go back to an oral medicine. It's something that will continue to be tracked. But your best hope to stay off medicine would be, you know, to do the things we talked about in terms of lifestyle as best you can within the limits you have on dialysis.
Oh, okay. Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Yeah, that was very interesting. That was a good question. I think we have time for another question. We have another question on the line here?
Certainly do. Jane Niedermeyer, your line is open.
Thank you. I want to thank the Kidney Foundation for doing more for this disease than the regular disease companies. First of all, I have a problem with hormones. My Lipton doesn't tell my brain that I'm full, and my cortisone turns everything into fat. Plus the fact that I was on metformin for 10 years, I contacted diabetes when I was 80 years old. Would you believe that? And then Walgreens notified me that no one over 80 should be on metformin. So now I'm on glipiride, but the side effects are awful. My legs are twice the size, and I've gained 10 pounds in 3 months. So I don't know what to do. And I've never seen a dietitian, and I've never seen a diabetic doctor. They just don't have any here, or they don't care.
Yeah. Okay, Marjorie, let's see if Dr. Tuttle can respond to that.
Well, some of the things that you talked about, you know, are correct. Glyburide is safer in the setting of kidney disease, but it is associated with weight gain, which it sounds like is something that you've struggled with, weight gain and swelling.
Right.
And, you know, it's hard if you can't access care, because actually it sounds to me like you need to see somebody who knows quite a bit about diabetes in the setting of kidney disease, because your situation is common, and there are ways to manage it. So I guess one of the things I'd like to ask the Kidney Foundation people is maybe they could help her with a referral to somebody who would be able to manage this problem for her.
I really need a dietitian. I've tried and tried for 4 years to try to get a dietitian, and there aren't any around here.
Well, Marjorie, let me give you a phone number here and a contact name, somebody that you can call. They'll be available tomorrow from 9 to 5 Eastern Standard Time. And do you have a pen there?
Yes.
Okay, the number is 800.
Yes.
622-9010. Yep, and you can ask for Marilyn Schwartz.
Marilyn Schwartz. Okay.
Okay, and we thank you very much for your call, and I'm sure that Marilyn will be available to help you out tomorrow.
Wait, I just also wanted to mention that you came here in 09, and it was discovered I had protein in my urine.
Well, that's the advantage of those KEEP programs that I was mentioning earlier,
yeah.
The kidney early evaluation screening programs, and they're free, so check the website. You can find out when they're coming to your area, and it's a great opportunity. People should really take advantage of that. Thank you, Marjorie, for the call. I appreciate it.
And a friendly reminder, especially to some people who may not be real facile with the Internet, you can always call the National Kidney Foundation. Remember, like Gary said, if you don't feel comfortable using the Internet, call them and there will be someone there to help you.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. Thank you, Dr. Tuttle. And I'm told that we're going to go till 8:30 here, so as long as people have questions, please keep them coming.
Okay.
And, you know, just before we get to the next question, I'll remind people once again that we're going to have another Coffee House Conversation, well, this one's going so well that we're going to do it again on Tuesday, July 13th. The topic for that one is what you need to know about diabetes and your kidneys. Why don't we go ahead and do the next question?
Hey, Elizabeth Pappas, your line is open.
Hi.
Hi, Elizabeth.
First, I would like to thank the American Kidney Association for having this. It's marvelous. I haven't been able to get any information. Then I want to move to Washington so I can be by Dr. Tuttle. But Rick has to move, too, so he can cook for me.
There you go. Right. Well, Dr. Tuttle
anyway.
Just said it was raining and 50 degrees, so you may want to think twice.
Yeah, and I'm in Florida, so trust me. It's not. I have a couple of questions, if it's okay.
Go ahead.
I have had 4 stents put in the last 2 years, 2 in my legs for PAD and 2 in my kidneys, and I don't know why, to be honest. And now I have high potassium, and I have chronic kidney disease, and my doctor, I guess, just isn't a big talker. And has me on a medication that 4 years ago I was told, because I keep notes, I was told I was allergic to for my blood pressure, but it affects my kidneys and my potassium. And I want to come off the medicine, and she doesn't want me to. So I don't know what to do. And I know you can't tell me, but I'm just trying to
give you some general advice, Elizabeth, just sort of like conceptually and kind of an approach. First off, with regard to the stents, this is for large vessel disease. And I'm glad you brought this up, because we talked more about heart and stroke, but it's important to recognize that large...
I've had open heart surgery. And
there you go. And I
am supposed to have, I have valve.
A heart valve problem?
Yes.
Well,
but they can't do surgery because I'm too high risk.
Well, yes, you have a lot of diabetic complications, and it's important to recognize that the large vessel disease can occur in the legs and in the kidneys. And we didn't really talk about that. Those are also really important problems. And with regard to the, you mentioned PAD, for those who are listening, That acronym is peripheral arterial disease. That means blockages in the large arteries to the legs. And
it means you walk a block and you go, ow, 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 sit down.
Exactly. And in the long run, this is one of the things that contributes to amputations or the loss of feet in addition to the nerve damage. So I think it's important because that takes us back to the importance of feet. So the discomfort is certainly an aggravation, but even worse, if left unattended, you could lose your feet. So that,
and I had it taken care of, and
right.
I've had no problems since then.
Right.
I mean, they did a good job.
Exactly. So that's the reason that people screen or physicians screen for PAD, if I can use that term, and try to do as best they can to preserve the circulation to your legs. With regard to your kidney stents, they're probably in your kidney arteries, and we call that condition renal artery stenosis. And it's actually common in people with type 2 diabetes because they have so much large vessel disease, but it's not diabetic kidney disease per se. Although you might have diabetic kidney disease too, it's possible. Many people, in fact, most people with diabetes, if they have the large vessel disease, also have the small vessel disease. And again, we don't know your particular circumstances, but the stents
right.
are to help preserve the blood flow to your kidneys. You said you didn't know why. If we put them in, that's the reason. And so whoever's taking care of you probably thought that you needed to improve the blood supply to your kidneys.
Yes. It's what I thought.
Well, thank you very much for this call.
May I bother you with one more question?
I wish we had time.
Kidney chef?
I wish we had time for one more, but, you know, you can get the answers. You can always call us here at 800-622-9010, or you can check our website. And, unfortunately, we have a lot of people waiting, so why don't we get to the next question here.
Hey, Anne, Bruno Gaston, your line is open.
Yes, good evening, everybody. I have a type 2 diabetes. I get it from my father's side of the family. My problem is that I've tried to maintain my blood sugar because I have found out that it's a history in our family, so I did everything that I could, but after I passed 40, I developed the diabetes. My problem is keeping my blood sugar at a low level in the mornings. I've had this problem for a while, and I've tried to maintain my diet. I was on metformin for almost 2 years, and I ended up having to take insulin. I'm taking, like, the slow-acting at night, and I'm taking 50-50 during the day. But once I go to bed at night and wake up in the morning, my blood sugar runs, like, 200, 198, from 198 up to maybe 250 or 270. And it's been going on for the past 6 months, and we've been working on it, trying to increase the insulin a little bit. But I don't know why my blood sugar goes up at night when I'm not eating, when it's like fasting time.
Dr. Tuttle, what do you think of that?
Well, it's interesting because we had a caller earlier with the opposite problem, going down at night. And these fluctuations in blood glucose at night are some of the most vexing problems that people with diabetes have, either too high or too low. And, you know, my answer to you is going to be has to be general, but it's similar to what I told the previous caller. You need some medication adjustment. And that's how we deal with either high or low blood glucose overnight. And I applaud your efforts for working on your self-management, and it sounds like you've given it a good effort, but I think it sounds to me like you would benefit from talking to whoever's managing your diabetes about a medicine adjustment, because you've gotten what you're going to out of self-management. So in this case, I'd refer you back to whoever's managing you, and there are strategies for adjusting medicines to bring the blood glucose down overnight, but not too low either, as we heard in the previous call.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I've done I do my exercises, I do what I'm supposed to do, and even they've adjusted the medication. So I'm thinking, is it, could stress cause it, or because I've tried all kinds of diets where even sometimes I skip dinner to see what the blood sugar would be, and I wake up like 3 o'clock in the morning testing it, 5, to see when it actually goes up?
You know, at some point, these aren't things that we can control. While lifestyle is really important, and it would be worse if you weren't trying so hard, you're not doing anything wrong. This is a situation where, in addition to the lifestyle factors that you're managing, that medication adjustment is indicated, and you've done what you can, but it sounds like you need to see a professional who may make an even more major change in your medicine in order to bring that nighttime blood glucose down. And there are ways to do it.
Thank you very much for that question. That was a good call. I appreciate that. And do we have another question on the line?
Lisa Bennington, your line is open.
Hi, Lisa.
Hi. Just tailgating on that last question, is it more difficult to keep your blood sugar in control if you also have kidney disease?
That's a great question. I think that it is, Lisa, because you have a number, when kidney function begins to decline, there are a number of other complexities to the management of your diabetes, and they relate to how your body clears or doesn't clear the medicine out of your body, other dietary restrictions, activity limitations, and then a lot of other illnesses often come along with kidney disease, as we've talked about, you know, particularly cardiovascular disease. So, yeah, I think we need to validate that for you. It's not nearly as easy as if you're a new-onset diabetic. And that's one of the reasons that the guidelines have changed to less stringent control in people who have what they call comorbidities, and that mainly means things like kidney disease and cardiovascular disease, because it's more difficult and then it becomes more risky, especially in terms of developing hypoglycemia or low blood glucose.
Thank you very much. Thank you for that question. Thank you for the call. And we'll take another one. Do we have another question on the line? No?
Well, I had one, but never mind. It's all right.
Go ahead. Go ahead and ask the question.
Yes. Hello?
Yes, hello. Go ahead. Do you have a question?
Oh, you didn't say my name, so I didn't know I was on the air.
Oh, I'm sorry. What is your name? What is your name?
Cindy Lundquist.
Hi, Cindy. Thanks for calling.
I want to tell you, you kept saying exercise, so I'm on the recumbent bike. I've now ridden 41 minutes.
Well, that's 41 minutes more than I've done in a long time.
Oh, you know what? I want this to get over, cuz, so I can quit.
Off.
Hey, my question is, you talked about stages of kidney disease. Can you tell me what those are?
Sure. Stage 1 and stage 2 are mostly defined by starting to spill albumin in the urine. The difference between 1 and 2 is a slightly lower GFR level in 2 than 1, but still within what we would consider relatively normal range.
Mm-hmm.
Stage 3 is defined by overtly low GFR, which means low kidney function, or the filters are starting to plug up. They aren't cleaning the blood. They may not be getting all the fluid off. Stage 4 is even lower kidney function, and then that's when we start to see the complications become even more evident. Somebody mentioned, I believe, anemia earlier. Anemia becomes more pronounced. Problems with bone and related mineral metabolism, which are things like the phosphorus level. And then at stage 5 is essentially end-stage kidney disease, which is usually treated by transplant or dialysis because the kidneys are no longer capable to function at a level that would sustain life for very long.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for the question.
And Cleo Richard, your line is open.
I have a question for Rick. Rick,
okay.
I'm wondering about your vascular access and what vascular accesses you have had. And if you think with any kind of changes in your diabetes mellitus have occurred, have those changes, you think, affected your vascular access?
I'm not aware of any changes in my diabetes with the onset of the chronic kidney disease.
Uh-huh.
I'm still treating it much as I always have. I take insulin in the mornings and in the evenings, and stick to the diet and try to get some exercise. I don't really know what to tell you.
Okay. What kind of vascular accesses have you had?
I only have rats. What is the surgery doing on your arm?
A fistula?
A fistula. And they also went back and raised the new artery closer to the skin and closed off some little side vessels.
Dr. Tuttle, may I ask you to comment on the dialysis access as well?
Was the question what type of access should be used in people who have diabetes?
No, my question was just to Rick about his experience with vascular access, that's all.
All right.
I just wanted to know his experiences.
I think he answered it.
Yeah. I think he did too.
Okay.
Thank you.
I think you're right. I'm sorry. Thank you very much for the call. Thanks, Rick. Thanks for helping there. And I think
we actually have no more questions.
Oh, well, that's great. And having reached the end of our questions, I can say once again, I just want to thank Rick and Dr. Tuttle for joining us tonight. This was really very, very informative and very helpful to a lot of people, and I appreciate you guys joining us tonight. I'll tell people once again where to get more information. Here you can go to the National Kidney Foundation's website, which is www.kidney.org, and we can have a list of resources available to you on the site, or you can call us here at 800-622-9010. It's 800-622-9010. For everybody that's been on the call, you're going to get a package of resources that are going to be sent out. And inside the package is a list of organizations, there's websites, there's telephone numbers, and some other information there that you can contact to get more information. So lastly, I'll tell you that we're going to have another Coffee House Conversation call. It's going to be on Tuesday, July 13th. Once again, the topic for that one is going to be what you need to know about diabetes and your kidneys. And I guess I'll just thank everybody once again. We're going to ask you... if you don't mind, stay on the line for just a couple of minutes. There's a quick survey. We'd love to get a little bit of information from you guys. And it's very simple to do, and the operator will walk you through that. And thank you very much again for joining us, and have a great evening, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you, Gary. There's six questions tonight. The first one is, did you find this Coffee House conversation useful? The answers, there are three answers. Make sure you press star. So star 1 is yes, star 2 is for somewhat, and star 3 is for no. And again, the question is, did you find this Coffee House conversation useful? Again, star 1 for yes. Star 2 for somewhat, star 3 for no.